So I want to speak about evangelical failure. And by that, I don't mean a failure to evangelize, but rather a form of evangelism that takes place in and through failure. So there are going to be two parts to my talk. The first, three actually. The first to directly address our failures, my failures, and then to talk about failure itself and to put a little bit of a different spin on some of familiar stories from the lives of the saints and the scriptures. Pardon me. And then, if there's time, last of all, maybe do a practicum, if the whole thing doesn't end up a practicum. So, the first part of my talk is on the elephant in the room. Not so much the elephant as the room itself. The first reading at my ordination mass was the call of Elijah. I'll bet it was the first reading at most of your ordination masses. Except that I remember it really clearly because the lector at my ordination mass left out the last sentence. Which, those of you who remember, it's the part where he says, "Here I am, send me." Which is the whole point of the reading, right? Fast forward 14 years, and I smile condescendingly on that young monk who would dare make such a demand of God, "Send me." And there have been times when I questioned the wisdom of the decision I made that day. Knowing how hard the life of a prophet can be, why would any of us volunteer for it? Now, the gospel reading at that Mass also played a large role in my discernment. At a crucial moment during my novitiate, when I was certain that St. Louis Abbey was not for me, I had a very vivid daydream. And, well, this itself is not unusual. I spend really most of my life daydreaming. But on this occasion, I had been reading about the call of Peter, and I imagined that I too was on the beach that day at Gennesaret. You can see where this is going. And I too was packing up my fishing nets and tackle. And when I looked up the beach, there was Jesus. And he was walking along the shore in my direction. And he was choosing apostles. So on he came. And he was walking toward me. And as he drew closer, I could see the look in his eyes. And he came closer and closer, and just as he got to my boat, he stopped, turned around, and chose the guy in the boat next to me. And then he walked away. So is this a sign that I was not called to the priesthood? Well, had I felt relieved, I'd say yes. But instead I got angry, and I rebooted the daydream, and I ran after Jesus, calling out, "Wait, wait! You forgot me. Choose me. Send me." Now, this has been a hard few years to be a priest. And they have been the hardest yet for my beautiful community in St. Louis. But I knew when I signed up that we might have a hard go of it. I was told that we were likely to lose men. An old monk warned me that the life of a Christian was not easy, and that I would find myself on the front lines of a war for souls. And I was told that every soldier, when he comes face to face with the enemy, questions his decision to fight. But a good soldier knows that, for the sake of his brothers in arms, he must stand his ground. I was sharing this with some of my students not long ago. One of them said, "Look, you guys may be the Navy SEALs of the church, but this is like Black Hawk Down or something." Well, when I read the papers, it does start to feel a little like Black Hawk Down. But you know, there were guys who deliberately parachuted into that mess. And knowing the odds, they deliberately put themselves in harm's way. And they wanted to be there. And I believe those men were heroes. And I believe you're heroes. That wasn't in the script, but I believe it. And here we are in the thick of it. And the pressure is sometimes unbearable. And the enemy has us surrounded. And some of us are very discouraged. Some have run away, right? Some have simply cracked under the pressure of it. But I told my students, and I've told my brother monks, and I'll tell you too, there is nowhere in the world I would rather be right now. And you all parachuted in, and I'm grateful. Lately, I've been thinking about Winston Churchill. Not a great theologian. Probably not a saint, but a great soul. A steadfast soul. A soul who, when it looked like his people were likely to lose heart, he gave a speech which steeled their resolve. Well, my father's a military historian, so I grew up with this stuff day and night. And I find myself reciting his words in a new context. I have nothing to offer but blood, toil, tears, and sweat. We should prepare ourselves for hard and heavy tidings. And I have only to add that nothing which may happen in this battle can in any way relieve us of our duty to defend the cause to which we have vowed ourselves, nor should it destroy our confidence in our power to make our way through disaster and through grief to the ultimate defeat of our enemy. And when we see the originality of malice, the ingenuity of aggression which our enemy displays, we may certainly prepare ourselves for every kind of brutal and treacherous maneuver. But at the same time, I hope with a steadfast eye. For even though many have fallen, or may fall, into the grip of the enemy and all the odious apparatus of his rule, we shall not flag or fail. We shall go on to the end. We shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength. We shall defend our home, our church, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landings. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender. Or to put it in more biblical terms, do not worry about tomorrow. Tomorrow will take care of itself. So that's the serious part. I promise not to cry through the rest of the year. So the second part of my talk is about failure and evangelization through failure and in the lives of the saints. I don't know, actually know who this guy is, but he's having a terrible day. And I love the look on his face. He's like, well, that didn't work. But he also kind of looks like he's ready to go back in. Anyway, yeah, if any of you know who that is, he's a Dominican, apparently, so good luck.
St. Peter
Martyr. Oh, yeah? Okay, well, we can talk about him later. I'm collecting my favorite failure saints, so if any of you have some, let me know about them. But I actually want to start with someone else. In the greatest scene of Western literature, and I'll stand by that, the enraged warrior Achilles, who is unbeaten and unbeatable, stands outside his tent on the beach of Troy while three ambassadors beg him to rejoin the battle. And Achilles, unmoved by their appeals and their tears, he answers, I hate that man like I hate the gates of death who says one thing but harbors another in his heart. Will I forgive Agamemnon? Not for all the world, not now that he has torn my honor from my hands. It's a shocking passage, a powerful passage, but also a little confusing, because we moderns have to ask ourselves how anyone could steal another man's honor, how you can take another man's honor from his hands. And the answer is this, in a nutshell: the Greeks of the Bronze Age measured their honor in stuff and reputation, time and kleos, they called it. And we sometimes translate it honor and glory. So time, the more stuff you had, the more honor. And if someone took your stuff, they literally took your honor out of your hands. Someone stole your cow. If I stole your cow, I stole one cow's worth of honor from you. And to recover that, you would have to take a cow from me, plus maybe a little more. So when Agamemnon, the general of the Greeks, steals Achilles' slave girl, he literally steals a slave's worth of honor. And Achilles never recovers from this, because honor is a zero-sum game in the Greek world. The more of it you get, the less I have. I was talking about this with my classic students, and one of them brought in a rap song by Kendrick Lamar. Don't really recommend it to this crowd, but he is a genius. He is. If you're into rap, I recommend it. But it's a really interesting thing. It starts off with, he grew up, I think, in Compton, and he said, I was in this gang, and it was all money and reputation, money and rep, money and rep. He says, but I got out of it. I worked my way up, and now I hang out with politicians and rock stars and actors, and it's all money and reputation, right? Now, so the reason I tell you this story is because I think Achilles has begun to make a comeback. And I think as a culture, we've begun once more to measure our honor in material, external things. And the kids are beginning to feel the stress of it, especially since you can now literally measure your reputation online. You can measure it. But my purpose here tonight, this morning, I was up late with the Dominicans. I'm not going to whine about how lousy the world has become for our kids, but rather to propose solutions, to offer antidotes, and I offer them in the form of four familiar stories, five people actually, five saints, four stories, and I'm going to put a bit of a different spin on it. And as I move from one story to the next, I want you to keep Homer's invincible hero, Achilles, in the back of your mind. So our first failure saint, John the Baptist. He ate bugs. Really, you can stop there. But I'll continue. He wore uncomfortable, unattractive, homemade clothes, died young, was by his own admission unworthy to unfasten the sandals of his successor. And when his own followers decided to abandon him, he actually encouraged them to do so, saying, well, I must decrease so he can increase. What a sad thing to say. Can you imagine any politician, movie star, superhero, CEO saying something like that today? Well, I must decrease so Bernie can increase. I must fail so someone else can succeed. Like most of the prophets, John was murdered by the very people he was trying to help. He was preparing them for a man they would eventually reject, humiliate, and execute. And yet, right, Jesus himself said of this failure that he was the greatest man born of woman. He's one of the few saints in the Roman calendar who has two feast days devoted exclusively to him, right? One is his birth, the other is his beheading. Story number two, if you can call it that, Saint Simon and Jude. Here are two men who own nothing and about whom we know very little, really. St. Jude was confused with Judas so often he becomes the patron of lost causes. What's more, the gospel writers themselves can't seem to keep his name straight, right? John calls him Judas, but not the Iscariot. Luke calls him Jude, the brother of James. And Matthew calls him Thaddeus. Nothing is said about him in any of the Gospels except that he asked one question. Anybody here know what it was? John 14, 22. What's this? That's it from Jude. There is a New Testament letter that bears his name, but virtually everyone agrees that someone else wrote it for him. And we know even less about Simon. Mostly, he goes by not Peter. Luke calls him Simon the Zealot, and Mark call him Simon the Canaanite. That's it. How'd you like to go through life being known as not that guy? That's it for Simon and Jude. They even have to share a feast. This is my personal favorite. And apparently this is an accurate likeness. So take a good look at that face. Though he is a refreshing change of pace, Edward's a king. By the standards of the time, obscenely rich, singularly influential. However, historians agree he was probably the worst politician in the history of Britain. King Edward, son of Ethelred the Unready, an inauspicious beginning if ever there was one, weak, impotent, this is a quote by the way, weak, impotent, timidly, and famously ugly. In worldly terms, a complete disappointment. During the course of his reign, Edward lost all his money without accumulating any political power. In fact, he allowed himself to be used as a puppet by, of all people, his mother-in-law. Then, when she's done with him, a pack of foreign con men took over. And despite his marriage to an intelligent and beautiful woman, he never managed to produce an heir, which is the one thing even an incompetent monarch can usually pull off. Yeah, well, hard as a thing. Some claim that this was his choice, actually, because he secretly wanted to be a monk. Most believe that his wife just could not bring herself to fulfill her duties. In fact, King Edward the Confessor left to history a reputation for weakness, indecision, financial incompetence, and yet, he is England's most popular saint. He built the world's greatest abbey at Westminster, and over 1 million people come every year, even today, to visit his tomb. Local gal. Well, local for me. She's buried in St. Louis. St. Rose Philippine Duchenne. Now, I'm going to quote from her biography because I gave this talk, well, a variation of it, well, actually just this part, to some Sacred Heart nuns, and it did not go over well. So I'll just read this paragraph from her biography, her words, not mine, by Marion T. Horvat. The first order she entered closed. She did not feel realized in the second convent until she came to America to convert the Indians. Then, instead of carrying out this long-desired mission, she was ordered to teach girls and found convents. The work was more difficult because she never learned to speak English. She founded one convent that failed, then another that kicked her out. The girls, she said, were ungrateful and worldly. The sisters chafed under her governance and wanted to relax the rule. When she was finally permitted to go to work in an Indian mission, she was already 72 years old, too old to work or to learn the native language. After 1 year, she was denied even that great consolation. She was ordered to leave the Indian mission and return to Florissant, Missouri. I've been there. It's awful. And there she died, having converted exactly one Indian, who apostatized 3 months later. And yet, she was utterly faithful to her call as a missionary. And a century after her death, when the Jesuits finally showed up to do the job right, the Potawatomi Indians still remembered her. They said, oh, that's what she was doing. We remember her, the woman who prayed. I don't know how he made it in there, actually. That's St. Stephen, I think. Those aren't eggs. Saints like this would have baffled Achilles. Simon and Jude died without Timae or Cleos. Edward squandered his political influence and his inheritance. John the Baptist had his head cut off. Rose Philippine Duchenne died penniless and disappointed. No honor or glory here, not by ancient Greek standards. In fact, these folks come up pretty short by our modern standards as well. And you have to wonder at the church's logic when it holds up people like this as role models. And yet, right, that is the logic of the cross. A logic which redefines success, turns human wisdom on its head. In the light of the cross, failure becomes promise. Right? Weakness becomes strength. The meek and the humble inherit the earth. This is why Nietzsche ridiculed Christianity as a religion of the weak. We come from a long line of failures. Sometimes we actually seem to take pride in that. You know, Mother Teresa was asked if she could possibly hope to succeed in India where the poverty was so overwhelming. You can probably recite her response with me. God does not expect us to be successful. He expects us to be faithful. Well, this quotation has come to mean a lot to me in my work, especially in my work in our high school, because in addition to my teaching and praying, I also coach a rugby team, which has not had a winning season in over 14 years. That wasn't a joke. In fact, we only broke even once. We were 4-4, and that year my players tore down the goalposts. Now, some might argue that a losing streak of that magnitude may have had something to do with my coaching, but I prefer to look at it in biblical terms. You see, God has a special affection for losers. And you look at all the losers in the long, baffling history of our salvation, starting with the Israelites themselves, whose finest king seemed to have a thing for other men's wives, continuing right through to the age of the apostles, whose first unanimous decision was to run away. To our own age and people like St. Philippine Duchenne. So when it comes to losing, I sometimes convince myself that it is a sign of God's special affection for my team. Right? For every failure reminds us that our beauty, our value, our integrity do not lie in our accomplishments, but simply in our existence as sons and daughters of God. That said, when it comes to evangelizing through failure, it's important to make one thing really clear. Failure is bad. Right? Like all forms of suffering, it is a consequence of original sin. It's natural, even wise, to avoid failure whenever possible. But just as there is a tendency to romanticize suffering as though it were a thing to be sought out, right, or worse yet, enjoyed, so there can be a tendency to romanticize failure as though it were just an alternative form of success. Like suffering, however, failure is transfigured and enriched and elevated in the light of the cross, which was, if you think about it, the fusion of humanity's greatest failure with its greatest victory. So just as it was Christ's vocation to die on the cross, so our sons and daughters, our parishioners, our brothers, may be called by God to fail from time to time. In fact, I think it's fair to say that we will all inevitably be called to fail on some level. But the good news, with a capital G, is that if we can teach our people, if we can teach ourselves, to unite that failure with Christ's own suffering, it transforms into this tremendous good. Not just an opportunity to grow, right? But a participation in the redemptive sufferings of Christ. Secondly, I'd like to distinguish between failing and being a failure. A parallel can be drawn, I think, between sinning and being a sinner. When we say, "Lord, be merciful to me, a sinner," I think it's important to remind people that we do not mean by that to define ourselves by our sins. We're sinners, but our identity is in Christ. Martin Luther used that famous analogy of the dunghill covered by snow to illustrate his theology of humanity's utter depravity. "We're all basically poop," he said. But Jesus hides this from God beneath the snow of his grace. Dead wrong. It's wrong because it does not acknowledge the fundamental goodness of God's creation. Oh, I'm going to go off script. This is where I get in trouble. My sister had a surprise kid 3 years ago, and I was playing with her in the living room, and I got up to leave, and she said, "Gussie," she said, "Where are you going?" I said, "To the bathroom." She said, "You gonna poop?" I said, "I might." She said, "It's gonna be stinky." I came back later, and she's thinking. I was like, "What are you thinking about, Georgia?" She says, "Did Jesus poop?" I said, "Yeah. I think, yes, he did." She goes, "Cool." Yeah, and I think, again, this is where I get myself in trouble, but I think she sort of figured out the incarnation, right? I mean, the reason why foul words are sinful is because they attach this shame that doesn't belong to these acts, right? For Georgia, this is something she can do really well, and it makes her like Christ. Right? This is the infusion of divinity into creation, into our humanity. Our identity, then, to get back to the script, is in our goodness, okay, not our sinfulness. So we may fail in our endeavors, but we are not failures at heart. Not while we remain united to Jesus and his church. Which is why we can rejoice even when the hour looks darkest. My best friend in grad school was a self-professed, well, still is, bitter ex-Catholic. And he used to say, "The problem with you Catholics is that when you're happy, you're happy. But when you're miserable, then you're really happy." Well, it's true. There's something really beautiful about the way Christianity can transform suffering into joy, which is why we look to saints like Edward and Philippine for inspiration, and why it is such a disappointment to hear people recite platitudes like, "You can do anything so long as you put your mind to it." Never going to be a brain surgeon, right? And if you're lying there and you see me coming for you, run for the hills. You're perfect just the way you are. Think outside the box. Follow your dreams. Not if they're stupid dreams. Not if they're evil dreams. Think inside the box. The box was built for a reason. Okay, I'm going off script again. I had this great student named Chad Huber, who I quote regularly. He decided his eighth grade year that he was an atheist and stayed an atheist until he got to college when he realized it was going to be more annoying to be a Catholic. So he went back to Mass. But he was, I teach this ethics class, and he turned around to the rest of the class and he said, "You call yourselves Catholics, but I know you. I see you on the weekends. I know what you do. At least I'm true to myself." Got to give the kid credit for having some guts. But a kid in the back row, who I thought was asleep, looked up and goes, "Yeah, well, at least we're trying to be true to somebody better than us." Don't be true to yourself. Be true to somebody better than yourself. And you can't do anything just so long as you put your mind to it. If I have time at the end, I'll tell you about Christopher Dench. I'm obsessed with Christopher Dench. Anyway, no one is omnipotent but God. In my work, I attend a lot of high school graduations. And, well, if any, I bet a bunch of you run high schools. So at every, just about every, well, I hear a lot of valedictorian speeches. And just about every one of them sounds like this. You already know what's coming. Parents, faculty, monks, well, maybe not that. Esteemed students of the blah, blah school. It is a great honor to be here, blah, blah, blah. Our ups and downs, blah, blah, blah. Insert funny story here, blah, blah, blah. Maybe something about God, blah, blah, blah. Never thought we'd make it, blah, blah, blah. But with a blah, blah education, you'll be prepared to go out and change the world. So follow your dreams and be true to yourself and think outside the box and remember that you're perfect just the way you are, blah, blah, blah. Thank you. Well, not all of them sounded exactly like that. But enough did that I finally sat down and wrote my own graduation speech. Predictably, I was never asked to give it until last April. So here it is. Oh, good. I'm going to make it to part three, probably. Right. Where are we? Yes. Parents, faculty, monks, and esteemed students of the blah, blah school, you are all going to fail. Over the next few years, you will all inevitably have your hearts broken, experience loneliness, miss a major opportunity, lose a game, lose a job, lose some money, be abandoned and ridiculed, humiliated and scorned. You, my friends, are destined for failure. And that is very, very sad. But it's also okay. Because your God had his heart broken and was ridiculed by his friends. And your God was humiliated and scorned and abandoned. And that means that your dignity is not bound up with your success. You are a child of God. You have been divinized. And in the end, when you lie on your deathbed, as we all inevitably do, without trophies or diplomas or accolades or even your bodily health to comfort you, all that will matter is your existence as a child of God, and that will be enough. That will be more than enough. It'll be everything. Oh. So I have a little, that went faster than I thought, so I included a couple of extras, if you don't mind. My new favorite saint, Moses the Black, also known as Moses the Ethiopian. I'll just tell you the story, unless there are questions. If you got a question, just jump right in. And the year I discovered this saint, virtually everyone in the eighth grade confirmation class took the name Moses the Black as their confirmation name. People were coming to me, "What are you teaching these kids?" He was a 5th century brigand, and the story goes that He was hungry, so he decided to steal a sheep. He lived in North Africa in the desert, and he worshipped the sun because the sun was the most powerful thing he knew. And he decided to steal a sheep, but the shepherd's dog barked at him, so he killed the dog, and then he killed the shepherd, and then he killed all the sheep because he was on a roll, I guess. And this angered the locals, as you might imagine, and he ran to a nearby monastery, I think it's Skeet. I'm getting some of the names wrong here. But anyway, when he arrived, he killed the porter and hid himself in the monastery. And when the crowd, the mob, arrived at the front door, they said, "We're looking for Moses, the outlaw." And the porter, the new porter, newly appointed porter, I assume, said, "Oh, he's nearby. We just saw him." So they went on running. And Moses said something like, "Oh, you're that scared of me?" And they said, "Absolutely not." He said, "Well, who do you worship?" And he said, "Jesus." He said, "I'm in." Apparently, he didn't quite get the point off the bat because he kept beating up people anyway. In fact, some of his old brigand buddies showed up at the monastery to rob it, and he beat them up, tied them up, dragged them up to the abbot's office, and was like, "What do you want me to do with these guys, boss?" And he's like, "No, Moses, you gotta let them go." And they were so impressed, they all became monks. But the great story they tell about Moses is that one of his brethren was caught doing something shameful, and they decided to excommunicate him. But you can't do that without a vote from the community. So they all assembled in the chapter house, and Moses wasn't there. And when he finally showed up, he was carrying a backpack full of sand. It had a hole cut in the bottom of it. And they were like, "Moses, yes." Sand goes flying out. And every time they addressed him, more sand would empty out onto the floor. And they said, "What are you doing?" He said, "Well, I'm here to judge my brother. Meanwhile, my sins, like the sand in this backpack, fly out behind me." So they elected him abbot. And anyway, the reason I think he's my favorite, one of my favorite failures, is that the Vandals eventually invaded North Africa, rampaged, destroyed virtually everything in their path, hence the name, or rather the name comes, well, whatever. The monks had to escape out the back, and he said, "I'll hold them off while you guys get out." And apparently on the way out, one of the novices had a sword and said, "Now's your chance. Do your thing." He said, "I can't." He said, "No, it's no sin." He says, "I know it's not a sin. I just enjoy hurting them." So instead, he held the doors, and they killed him as his brethren got out the back. Blessed Justus Takayama Yukon, the only samurai saint. Is that great? I actually made holy cards to give to you, but forgot to bring them. So, hence the practicum on failure. I'll put them on a table or something tomorrow or the next day. The Jesuits converted him, and he decided to kill anybody who wasn't Catholic. And they said, "No, that's not how you do it." So he famously said, "Hereafter I fight not with the katana, but with the words of our Lord Jesus Christ." And his neighbors killed him, because apparently the katana was pretty useful in some respects. But they exiled him to the Philippines, where he died of malaria. Poor guy. And, of course, St. Olav of Norway, who has a very similar story. Apparently, being a Viking and being a Catholic don't mix. So he, too, was killed by his neighbors. So I recommend using guys like this, stories like this, told like this. I find that my students, especially as in light of the immense pressure that we're putting on ourselves in social media and the pressure that leads to things like this scandal in California, that looking up to people like this, I think, is a solution. It's a small solution, but it's the one I propose. I think that's my talk. Thank you. That's no way to end a lecture. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit.